I'm Ed Senny, and I teach in the theology department. I'm chair of the theology department at Valparaiso University. Now, Valparaiso University, for you people out here in the Northwest, is in Indiana, and it's just about 50 miles from the Chicago Loop, a little south of the lake there. And at Valparaiso University, which is a Lutheran university, again, in case you didn't know that, we have a few people here who could verify that, whom I knew from Valparaiso University already. I have been teaching there in the theology department, mostly as it happened. Now, I guess that's the way God calls us into certain kinds of things. As it happened, they had a need for people, someone to teach in world religions way back in 1962 or 3, and they gradually nudged me in that direction, and I went away to study it and teach it, and it's been happening ever since for 25 years. Last week I was doing some topics on what we usually refer to as several of the major world religions. That may not be quite appropriate. I did Islam. That certainly is one of the major world religions. I did Baha'i, which is a universal religion, but only 100 years old, and I don't know whether it should be classified as one of the major world religions, but it is a significant thing at least. And then I did Hinduism, and then we talked on Saturday about the attitudes and viewpoints that Christians might have in their meeting with their neighbors of other faiths. That is, what do Christians have to say about religious people out there who are not Christians? And what ought our attitude to be. So those are things I did last week. And this week I want to talk about Native Americans, people that got called Indians. Now, the purpose of my series, talking about the religious practices of Native Americans, is to simply lift our awareness again of those people who were here for so long before, I suppose you could say, before we discovered them. They were here for a long time. I want to lift that to awareness again and reflect on what that might mean. So we hope to have some discussion. I am so impressed around Holden here with the gathering of people that I wouldn't be surprised if there'd be a number of you who could easily do a session on some aspect of things Native American, or maybe even religion, because you've traveled and a lot of you have studied a lot of these things. So I hope I can leave enough space for you to disagree, to contribute, to add to your perspectives to whatever I may have to say. So I do it also to inform you, if that's what you need, is information. I think there'll be some. And bigger than that, I think that when we touch the spirit of other peoples of other cultures and other religions, our own spirit is enlarged. We become more than we could have been without that encounter. It's like meeting another beautiful person. We're richer, we're fuller than we were before. And so it certainly must be, I hope, for us as we can look at Native American things. We would like, I believe, in the name of God, to affirm, and I'll use that word again, appreciate the things that can be affirmed and appreciated in what we see in people's devotion to God and their attempt to understand him and his work and to give themselves to that. That's a word about the purpose of the series. The series itself will go something like this. Today I want to do some pretty general things, reminding ourselves about the coming of these people, how long they've been here. And so I thought up this little title, Before Abraham Was, since we like to start our stories of our tradition back there. before Abraham was, long before that, they were praying in North America. And what do we make of that kind of idea? Tomorrow, I intend to start right in on some ceremonies and to talk about the Oglala Sioux as an example of Plains Indians and their ceremony of pipe smoking as prayer, and their ceremony of the sweat lodge as prayer and purification, maybe confession and absolution is kind of close to what we see there. I want to do those things tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, I want to talk about the Plains Indian vision quest and the sun dancing as worship of God. Then I'm going to do something way out of bounds on Thursday and come back on Friday and do a something on when Indians receive Christianity and appropriate it their own way. And so the Yaquis of Arizona and Mexico, for that matter, but I met them in Arizona, just south of Phoenix, in Guadalupe, and I had the privilege of spending much of the time during Holy Week with them as they marched out and danced out their celebration of Lent and Easter. And I want to show you some things and talk to you about that. And then on Saturday, I intend to say a few things about sand paintings as religious ceremony and the Kachina dolls and the Kachina dances of the Hopis in the Southwest as worship. So that's the plan, and that's an awfully long introduction to a session, but that, if you would like to do those kinds of things, that's what you'll have here. We have some slides today, just a few on some Southwest American prehistory, some sites there, and you will be able to add to that from your slide collection easily, many of you. And tomorrow I'm going to start using some illustrations from a wonderful artist, Vera Drysdale, who illustrates. Obviously, she caught what Black Elk was talking about in his description of those ceremonies that I'm going to talk about, and she has made illustrations, beautiful illustrations. So while I talk about them, we'll look at beautiful illustrations for a few days of these matters. Okay, I've placed an outline of what I want to talk about today. Behind me here. The first thing I want to talk about is when human beings arrived in America. Now, many of us have at least a fair degree of trust in the processes that are used to date certain things in prehistory. Possibly not everybody has very much confidence in those things. But if we want to just accept what those experts are telling us, the debate will be somewhere between 30,000 years ago and 20,000 years ago that human beings were living in North America and probably in South America rather shortly after that. Now I think you have to stretch yourself and force yourself to think how long that is, because you know whenever we talk about prehistory we just throw numbers around like, and this country has been a nation for 200 years and white European culture has been working away at this thing over in this country for what, maybe 400 years. And that's a drop in the bucket. And we're saying that human beings have been on this land, moving about on this land, maybe 30,000 years. I'm not interested in the question of when they were human beings, particularly, but whenever it was that they laughed and cried and loved and worried and sweat and struggled and prayed. They were human beings. And that must go back a long, long time in this country. So I don't care too much about what the numbers are that you put up there. But it's so long ago. Who saw old Bonanza first? Who saw it? Do you ever wonder that? Who saw this stuff first? Who was the first one to see one of these peaks up here by Holden and say, thank you, Creator? I think that it helps me at least to start thinking that way. Because then I feel connected with that person. And I would like to suggest from my studies of religion that it helps us to feel connected to people who have gone long before us and far away as well. That we are part of them and they part of us. And in some ways we replicate their humanness. They're crying and they're laughing and they're praying and all of that. That's the first thing I want to invite you to think about. Of course, the theory on my nice darkened map here, the theory about how human beings got here, well, these are just theories, but I suppose the consensus is that from mainland East Asia, they came over across the Bering Strait. And you know that theory about the fact that during the Ice Age, so much of the world's waters were caught up in the great glaciers, that the ocean levels were lowered, and lo and behold, under that region, there is not too far down a great land bridge. And when that land bridge was exposed for, what, thousands of years? That's long enough for it to kind of quit being soggy. And people didn't know they didn't say, let's go from Asia to America, but they followed some caribou, and they followed some other animals because they were hunters. And as the herds moved, they moved their camps. And lo and behold, they're in another land, I guess, eventually. Not thousands of them at once, but an extended family of 30, 50. And then another one, and then another. And then from their coming here, they began to move. In all those thousands and thousands of years, it's not hard to imagine at all that they would move clear across North America, down through Central America and South America, and thousands of years ago, all those regions of the Americas have known the footprints of human beings. So that seems to be what was going on. And in those thousands of years, these human beings kept on changing. They never stayed the same. Human beings don't stay the same. The first contact that so-called Indian cultures had was not with white Europeans coming over here and meeting them with an entirely different culture. They met peoples from a few hundred miles away whose culture had developed different ways, and there was culture change, culture contact, culture clash, and all of that that went on then. That's part of the whole process of the migration. They developed not into one people with a label that we got stuck on them, Indians, but many nations, many peoples, many languages, divergent cultures, differences in their ways of being religious, along with all of that. That is so obvious, isn't it? But we just have to think about it, I think, to bring the whole matter back into perspective, that they filled this land, and they saw these mountain ranges, and they saw what we much more recently have appreciated. When we begin to draw our maps, and we always are, I am a map person, I love to quickly go to a map and say, well, now where were they? Well, the question, where were they, is really a troublesome question if you think of the thousands of years of migrations. Where was who when? The maps you usually see in textbooks are trying to tell us approximately where the Indian groups were, certain Indian tribes were, in the late 1800s. And so if you see the Sioux in South Dakota down here, you better remember that 100 years before that, they were up in Minnesota tending gardens, and they weren't riding horseback, and they weren't wearing feather bonnets, and they weren't doing any of those things. And so, you know, when? And if you look at where are they now, then you have all these names of the many, many, many tribes down in Oklahoma. But that isn't necessarily where they started. So just remember the whole thing, as we look at it historically, is dynamic. Movement, culture change, and all of that going on. So they created not only simple cultures of people hunting a few animals and picking the berries, but they created the great cultures, urban cultures as well, didn't they? The Aztec, the great kingdoms of the Central and South America, Incas, the Toltecs, and some of the others down there, the Mayans. And then in this country, we have begun to discover there are some pretty sizable urban cultures that developed here too, where large numbers of people live together. Anything but the picture that we are given by most textbooks that suggested that there were some scattered Indian tribes wandering, implied aimlessly about the land. Anything but that. But high cultures were developed. Cahokia Downs and Mesa Verde and numerous other places like that where we see these great cultures. And the mound builders. I've been visiting all sorts of mound builder sites in the east and the Ohio River Valley and so forth in recent years, trying to peek into that thing a little bit. Now I move to the second point of how is this all treated in American history textbooks. There probably are school teachers here, and maybe that will have a chance for you to suggest what you've been seeing. But I have an article in my file by a man named Frederick Hoxie, who did a study of college American history textbooks 1984 and 5, I believe he was included in this too. And he wanted to see what they had to say, what place American so-called Indians had in that history. And what you get, usually, today, in those most recent years, just a couple years ago, you get the figure of probably about 1 million people populated this country, and they were wandering about in scattered small tribes. The implication, of course, of that kind of picture of this history is that the land was empty. It's about time somebody who knew how to do something with it came over and took it over and started making it useful. The implication is there. It was an empty land, just a few of these strange people wandering around as though they didn't really know what they were doing. And that's what the textbooks seem to suggest. Or they may go a little further than that. But that number, like 1 million. Well, in the 1970s, a whole series of studies had been done that have conclusively shown that there were at least 10 times that many people in North America. And yet the new textbooks don't show that. Don't even show it. They just kind of keep repeating that old James Mooney number that he gave them 60 years ago, 1 million scattered peoples. So you have to think about, where does the history of this country begin? Does it begin in 1492, or whenever you Scandinavians would like to suggest that Leif made it? Or where does it begin? Jamestown? Plymouth? Or does it begin long before that? What sort of attention do you suppose for us and for our children, what sort of attention do you suppose the prehistory of this country ought to have in order to help them understand and appreciate better the kind of land that we live in? So history has its problems, and he showed quite a few other problems in the way we do our history. Of course, it starts with the naming of the people, Los Indios, the Indians. Well, Christopher was lost, and so he found himself by naming the people of this land what he hoped he was going to find. And so they have been stuck with that in our mind, lumped together in a word that was totally inappropriate in the first place, but that's okay. Finally, when we all got alert to this problem about how stupid it is to call all these native peoples Indians, and how many different peoples there were, and we invented another lumping term, see, another term by which to lump them all together, because it's a we, they world, isn't it? So we lump all them together, and we call them Native Americans. Well, that's another invented one, and another lumping one. And you know, about the time we got that across to each other, and we start talking that way, and all the textbooks start saying Native Americans, just don't call them Indians because we're too smart for that now, then they start calling themselves Indians. Why? Because they want to be connected with the other tribes. And it's about they need a lumping word so they can get together and hold hands across tribal boundaries and have some clout in this land where they haven't had any before. So I don't know what to call them anymore, but those people whom Columbus called Indians. So our textbooks have problems with things like that too. Then you of course have not the textbooks necessarily, but the movies, the media in general has given us these caricatures and stereotypes, and Indians, you know, the war bonnets and the horses, which the Sioux didn't have until, what was it, about early 1800s or something like that, when they finally got horses. And this picture of the big feathered war bonnet and a rider on the horses and either hunting buffalo or at war. A very recent picture and very limited picture of what Indian people, what these native people of this country were all about. So we have to just be thoughtful, I believe, about all such things. Let's switch to our eyes and less to our ears for a few minutes and have some slides. Is there someone back here who would be able to find that switch on the back? Yeah, thank you, Mark. And I'll just show you a couple things from... Let me pull this down there. No, I guess I have to stand pretty close. From the American Southwest, and is there a light, a way to knock that light out for the time being? And that one, and that one. That's the...
Switch of the other one.
The other one. Yeah, if you could have it, that one on and that one off, that'd be fine. But anyway, you can see it. I spent a little time in Arizona a couple years ago, and this isn't the oldest stuff by any means, and by no means the only thing, but it's just a way to reflect on what I've said about people living in this country. There were some people in northern Arizona from about 600 AD until about 1350 AD, who were called Sinawa, and that meant the waterless people who had to make a go of it without water. which wasn't quite true, but at least it did describe in a way the difficulties they had. And already at that time, we're fairly late in human cultural development in this country, cultural development. They have already become farming peoples. You understand, of course, that for thousands and thousands of years before there was planting and cultivating, there was just hunting and gathering. So we're really very late already in prehistory when we talk about these farmers as early as 600 AD. They were building houses like these, 2 and 3 stories high. Apartment buildings. There were some in this particular region that's right here called Wupatki. Some of you have probably traveled those parts just north of Flagstaff and have seen some of this. They have found at least 1,000 dwellings in this little region. It was a neighborhood, maybe even a city almost, that was here. This was functioning as a population center for at least 150 years. I always have to stop and remind myself, how long is 150 years? That's kind of quite a while. A lot of things happen. A lot of people die. A lot of people get born. A lot of crying. A lot of laughing in 150 years. While they were there, they developed things like arenas and ball courts. They probably, there at the bottom you see, what is that called? Metate and mano, the horn grinding stones right down at the very bottom of the slide there. So there's an arena. That was an arena, and we don't know quite what went on there, but probably ceremonial things, it is thought. There is a ball court, that's a different one, I believe, right there, and it's elongated, what is called a ball court for what is presumed to have been a ceremonial game that they learned from their southern neighbors, the Hohokam, or the Hohokam, from the Phoenix area, and southern and south of there, and Mexico, too, who had this ceremonial ball game of some kind. But just to see those kinds of things, the San Francisco peaks in the background, the Holy Mountains, the Sinai, the Mount Zion, the Olympus of this part of the country here, where the Navajo look and the Hopi look, and so many of the people of the Grand Canyon area look and say, ah, there's where the sacred power is really concentrated. Houses, apartment buildings. They had some, I have to speed through this, they had their problems with climate, and they had their problems with a volcanic outburst, and which left a Sunset Crater finally there. A couple hundred years of repetition of this eruption. And they moved down, a lot of them, a little further south to a place just east, I believe it is, of Flagstaff, where you have Walnut Canyon. And there they made their homes in these cliffs. I've got to run up there and make sure you all can start spotting these homes on the ledges down here, all over in there. When you look at it, when you stand above that, I mean, it just looks like a sheer cliff. Then you get on the trail, and you get in there, and you begin to see that, you know, there are ledges along here where you can walk in front of these houses. So they learned to live here in cliff dwellings, and below them was a stream at that time, which I understand, I don't remember this for sure, but I understand that is not there anymore. It's taken a different route. But above it are these mesa tops where they had their bulk corn and beans and squash gardens. And they'd go up and down to those gardens and their homes there, and the stream down below and the hunting of game down below by the stream. So farming the mesas and hunting along the streams, living in Walnut Canyon. There you see it a little closer, where some of these things, of course, as you know from your own travels, are reproductions. That is, they've taken the stones that were right there and all fallen down, and they've set them up again to try to replicate what it must have been. A lot of those cliff overhangs that already provide for you your ceiling and your back wall, and then they just have to put these partitions in and front walls, and they just did that all over this place. Of course, this isn't the only place you in the West where this has happened. This is one of them. But when you walk the trails in front of those cliff dwellings, can't you just hear Mama saying, "Be careful! Don't fall down! Don't go so close to the edge!" And somebody crying, fell down a little ways. Whew, not any further. There must have been a lot of heartache and a lot of worry and so forth that went on there. But children played here. And mothers worried. And fathers fell down sometimes, bringing the buck they had shot, bringing it back to the family, and they fell and hurt themselves. Oh. Connections. We're connected with them, aren't we? The Verde River Valley in northern Arizona, we're moving to another place here, had a lot of prehistoric farming communities, villages, I guess we could call them there. And this one happens to be called Tuzigut, which is up on top of that hill. And of course, I'm showing you the flow of the river first here, so you see why they're there, because they were doing a little farming too, and they irrigated. They always got that water out and got it over to where they needed it. And here is an attempt to reproduce, put all those stones that were laying around that mountaintop, to that hilltop, to put them back together in what seems to be the way the foundations were laid. And you had this one major house at the top, and then all these homes around it. I believe they figure at Tuzigut, at the later part of the settlement here, it were at least 92 rooms here. And you would enter those rooms by means of ladders. So it was a little bit like the pueblos of Mesa Verde and places of that sort. That's another picture from the top looking down on these, where the walls have been reconstructed to show us the rooms, but the ceilings have not been put on as they had been then, with timbers and mud and things of that sort. Cliff dwelling, this is called Montezuma's Castle, which has nothing to do with Mexico, nothing to do with Montezuma or anything, but it got misnamed like a lot of things do. But it's an apartment building, as it were, upon another cliff above Beaver Creek. There's a little closer shot of it, how they built that up in that safe place where they were protected from the north and west hard winter winds, and built themselves a home in there with trails and ladders to get up in there. And there were some 19 rooms in that one thing there that's called Montezuma's Castle, about 19 rooms. They were living there in a safe place from weather and a safe place from their human enemies, because they could see a long ways and defend themselves fairly well up there. But what you see below them is Beaver Creek, which provided them the water for their gardens. They were farmers too in this region. And that's an artist's blow up of what that castle, Montezuma's Castle, was. Five different levels, the many different rooms, and the artist even put little people in, models of people in there, doing things that they must have been doing. And I think we'll stop with the pictures with that. That's only to to illustrate, oh, there's tomorrow, we're some things that start tomorrow. Turn it off, please. And thank you on the light. That gets us to our fourth point. Really, I suppose what I wrote down there doesn't explain very much. But my point here is, what did Columbus and some of the other European visitors to this country have to say about the people they met over here? What did they think they were in those early days? And how has that changed as you go through to 1978? From Columbus, we learn that these people were not religious that he had met. They were very strange people. To quote him directly, "They should be good servants and very intelligent, for I have observed that they soon repeat anything that is said to them, and I believe that they would easily be made Christians, for they appear to me to have no religion." And so he goes on to talk about how that would be part of our project, is to teach them religion. And of course, religion is defined by the true religion, as he was a bearer of it. And in another one, he says, "They have no religion, and I think that they would be very quickly Christianized, for they have a very ready understanding." Fernando, Christopher's son, says he claims that he's writing his father's own words when he says, "I've not been able to discover any idolatry or other religious belief among them." That is, they're not even that far along. They're not even idolaters yet. "However," this is really wild, "however, each of the many kings in Hispaniola and the other islands and on the mainland has his special house apart from the village. This house contains only wooden images carved in relief and called by them Sinis. And here there is no other activity except the service of the Sinis, and the Indians perform certain prayers. They have no religion. They perform certain prayers and ceremonies here as we do in church." Well, things of that sort. And then you get to someone like Oviedo, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'll just say it that way, who produces a whole lot of evidence that what they really were is devil worshippers. They worship the devil. And others say that this land, in God's overall creation plan, this land was the land that was ruled by the devil, and therefore all the people here were misled by the devil. See, they came from another land, another culture, another religious worldview, and somehow, to make sense of what they see, they have to use their own categories to understand it and to talk about it. But the result was a thorough and complete depreciation of what was going on. They saw, but they didn't see. They didn't see what it really was that was right under their eyes. Because sometimes, you know, what we see is shaped by what we believe. And some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And so think about that one for a little while. I think that's the real truth. You've got to believe it to see it. If someone believes it, it's there. If they don't believe it, it's just not there. You just don't see it. So there was a lot of that kind of thing. William Penn has his theory that says that they were... the people they met over here should be treated nice. They were the 10 lost tribes. You see how categories from another framework have to be used to understand here. They were the 10 lost tribes. Maybe that's enough. Early in the Massachusetts Bay Colony already, in the month of June 1644, you have laws being established that anyone who lives, any of these native people who live within the boundaries of this rule that's now been staked out by that colony, must submit to Christian instruction and things of that sort. Well, I don't pretend I can do the history of this off the cuff like this and with the time and library shortage that I have right now, but it's a long story of that kind that, first of all, gives us to understand that they aren't religious at all, that they are savage, that they need to be civilized and then taught religion. And then as we go along, we find that the governmental authorities begin to, through their Indian agents, begin to prohibit and prevent the Indians from practicing their religious ceremonies. That, in fact, is what has went on until our day, practically. That is, I think you can make a clear case for the fact that the United States of America did not grant Indian people freedom of religion. Until 1978, when a bill was passed by the Congress and signed by Jimmy Carter that said that they now have a right to this. I was amazed when I realized this. Yes, it was on August the 11th, 1978 that Jimmy put his Jimmy Carter on it. And it says things like, whereas the freedom of religion for all people is an inherent right fundamental to the democratic structure of the United States and is guaranteed by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, whereas the United States has traditionally rejected the concept of a government denying individuals the right to practice their religion and as a result has benefited from a rich variety of religious heritages in this country, and I'm a little Indian people along the side, they laugh while they hear this. Whereas the religious practices of the American Indian, as well as native Alaskan and Hawaiian, are an integral part of their culture, tradition, and heritage, such practices forming the basis of Indian identity and value systems, we're getting it now in 1978, we're getting there. Whereas the traditional American Indian religions as an integral part of Indian life are indispensable and irreplaceable, whereas the lack of a clear, comprehensive, and consistent federal policy has often resulted in the abridgment, I'll say, of religious freedom for traditional American Indians, and so with some more whereases, resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that henceforth it shall be the policy of the United States to protect and preserve for American Indians their inherent right of freedom to believe, express, and exercise the traditional religions of the American Indian, Eskimo, Aleut, Native Hawaiian, including but not limited to access to sites. Certain mountains like Bear Butte and a few places like that around the country, and Taos Lake and some of those things. And possession of sacred objects and the freedom to worship through ceremonials and traditional rites. And so there have been a lot of lawsuits since 1978 where Indians said, now it's legal, we're going to go for it. And there are sweat lodges built in prisons, penitentiaries, and they have to be granted now. But before that, nonsense. So from Columbus to Jimmy Carter. And now we have at least said that they are to have freedom of religion. And they themselves, of course, do a lot of different things about it because Indians don't all do the same thing or think the same way about these things, but there are many of them that are now taking heart to reach back into their own cultural heritage and to try to understand and appreciate what their grandfathers and grandmothers were doing and saying and believing and practicing. And so there is, in some sense, I don't want to overstate this, a resurgence of traditional spiritual Native American practice. Don't want to overstate it, but it's happening to some extent, encouraged by something like that bill. The themes that we run across in this are, of course, pretty well known to, some of the themes are pretty well known to everyone. Creator, creature, and respect. I guess I heard it on the plaza at the Yaqui, the Yaqui's ceremonies in Guadalupe, south of Phoenix. I guess I heard him talk about our problem is with white men, he got no respect. And I'm a little confused. I said, you know, maybe, but for what? For anything. No respect for creation. No respect for his environment. No respect for other people. No respect for other people's religions. Comes here with a pad of paper and watches and writes a bunch of stuff down, takes pictures, runs back and writes a book, makes a bunch of money off of it, call that respect. That, things like that, they said. And I heard it over and over where I talked to some of these people, that they view the white folks around them as having no respect. It starts with this, creator and creature. And always having that in mind. So you can go through a book like this and you can have, read one creation story after another. From every group has its creation story. How it all got put together in the first place. Sometimes the one who is the most powerful in the beginning and who seems to be sort of the root power source of all of this is simply called the creator. Chief of the sky spirits is what the Modoc called them. The Crow called him Old Man Coyote. And the Cherokees simply referred to someone powerful. Cheyenne called him Great Medicine. And the Yakima called him Great Chief Above. And so on down. They get names. And they're colorful figures oftentimes. Sometimes they seem like the Plains Indian Great Spirit, but oftentimes much more exciting and lively and unpredictable and what are some of the words I need for? I don't know. But my point would be, quite universally, there is the sense that this does not just happen to be here. It is the work of a creator. It was created as gift, as the gift of life, and therefore it is to be appreciated, to be received with gratitude, to be protected with respect, and things of that sort. You just find it quite universally in the Indian cultures, that attitude, creator, creature. We are responsible because we are creatures of the great creator. Another theme, so we'll have that theme, and everybody kind of knows that, the attitude of Native Americans of being very close to all aspects of nature. Another way to look at that is the way they talk about this environment in the world. They seem to think that this universe is a universe of people. And so there are animal peoples, the four-legged people, and there are people, and if you don't believe it, they talk, and they wish, and they have broken hearts, and they do things, they act voluntarily, intentionally. So you have the four-legged people, you have the plant people, the standing people, as the Sioux call the trees, on all the great stand of trees, those are the standing people. And of course you have the sky as person, and the sun as person, and the earth as mother person, and on you go, the thunderbird people, the winged people, the fish flapping their tails as people. At least all these living things, and sometimes more than that. Sometimes Herb's rocks talk, not always. The Ojibwa would say, if you ask the old Ojibwa man, what do stones always speak and reveal? And the answer was, no, not always, but sometimes. That is, messages, that is, personality, personhood, being ascribed to all these things. Now, what's going on here? Because you read their stories, and you've got coyotes talking, and talking to the elk, and the fish, and they turn into people, and people turn into those other things, and it's back and forth. So it's a world full of persons, only some of whom are human. Now that's a way I suggest to you to think about the fact that that may not just be a superficial poetic device, but a way of experiencing the world. So that, in fact, you really experience this world as surrounding you with intentional beings with whom you interact, with whom you share life and love and respect and fear and all these things. I'm suggesting then that we are taught not to experience these as persons unless they are our pets at home. Other than that, either pet rocks or pet cats or dogs or something like this. Other than that, we are pretty well taught to experience them as non-person. But I'm suggesting that we are in the minority that way, as the world's population down through the ages has gone, that these stories operate on the level of animals talking and trees talking and things like that, because that's the way the world is experienced, as a great world of personal relationships. And that calls for responsible dealing in every direction, not just responsibility for other people, but responsibility for all the other non-human persons in the world too. I think I'm going to pass on this last one simply because I definitely want to give you a chance to share some of your thoughts about this, and maybe I'll have a chance in the next days to pick up for those of you who are interested to follow on landscape as religious meaning. So let's open it up to some questions or comments and sharing from you folks. Many of you have had so much experience with these things. Some of you have, I know.
I live next to Ogallala, Nebraska. And always was suspect of the way the history books taught us, because there was so much around us that was not the same way the books taught us. And so I came about my interest in American Indian sort of experientialist. And I had a niece who was visiting once, and she'd lived, you know, grown up in Wisconsin. I took her shopping one day and said we were going to stop where she could see that we were a live Indian. And she said, she was all three. She was only three. And her fear was so strong, because the images that she had heard and seen on television and everything made her scared. So I talked to her maybe 20 minutes on the car about that was something that maybe she could work through and maybe change that. Got to the Buffalo Bill Fort, unfortunately, that's the only place where he was. And he was standing there, and I had done such a wonderful job that she grabbed him around the knees and said, "I love you. I love you." And I didn't know exactly how he was taking it, and how I was going to try to get her, you know, somewhere in the middle between her fear and her deep love. But she has now, has from that experience, has taken and really looked at the history books with a lot more questioning about what was in them from that experience. That was my first experience, trying to change somebody's mind.
Consciousness raising, huh? Yes?
We have our Bible. We can go back to see where the roots of our religion was. How does a Sioux today, what do they go back? What do they reference to? How far, how many generations back can they get to a pure religion?
Well, how many generations can they get back is one kind of question. And it's kind of more like our kind of question than their kind of question. You see, most tribal peoples can live very happily with the notion, once upon a time, which is a kind of then time, now time, all time, no time, and then the meanings start pouring out of the story. So this idea that in order to validate it or understand it or something, we've got to go back and get its chronology put together is unique to our consciousness. I believe it's at least, if that's not an overstatement, it's close to the truth. So the first thing then I think is to realize there would be less concern about your question among most tribal societies. Second, they do pay some attention to things like that insofar as they can talk about genealogies back to the person who is said to be the one who first knew about the story of the coming of White Buffalo Calf Woman or something like that. Now, the other thing is that the idea that to go back to the beginning is to go back to the pure would not be shared necessarily at all. God didn't start things pure, and then ever since then they've been kind of getting messed up and going back to the beginning. But it's an unfolding process, and there is newness, and there is new revelation, and God gives new things in new times for people. That would be closer, I think, to their understanding of what their religion is. And as their culture changes in certain respects, things begin to be left behind. They drop off very slowly, of course. Ritualistic things hang on long after people have forgotten the meaning of them. But eventually they do get dropped off and replaced by other things. Does that speak to what you're asking?
Well, is it important for them to know what the religious practices and beliefs were of their people before the white men came? Do they view us as the great contaminators and that they have to at least get back?
I think a lot of them do have some concern about doing that, trying to understand that, if they can, to the extent that they can. Yeah, I think that some of them do. You take someone like Black Elk and the Sacred Pipe, he kind of went the way of getting converted to becoming a Roman Catholic, and then he was kind of reconverted back to being, to getting hold of his own tradition. And lo and behold, he got a hold of his own tradition and gives it back to us in some of these ceremonies with a kind of altered theology. He's got himself a new thing. We'll talk about that in the next days. But I think there is, by some of them at least, an interest in seeing going back as far as they can to understand how the old ones did it. But I don't think that they have the tendency to absolutize the truth that the old ones had, as though they had it and we can't have a new truth.
How do you relate all this to our call to spread the gospel?
Tonight there is going to be a forum, isn't there, Walt?
Right.
And that's
you
the forum.
You will answer that tonight.
The community will bounce that around tonight. A quick answer, though, it deserves at least some kind of response right now. And my suggestion would be that as a Christian, one who knows God through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ and who says, "Be witnesses now to me," I have no choice but to live out the love of God toward all people, them included. And whatever I find among them that can be affirmed as consistent with that loving pattern of God, I ought to affirm it. But nevertheless, my words and my life need to be the witness of the suffering servant, the one who takes other people's causes and burdens and bears them and lives out that kind of love toward them. And that much at least I think I can say right now. But what what else I say about that, I'm going to be really rigid about obeying the rules of the community, for not because they are rules to be obeyed, but because of your time plans are to be respected. And so it's our time to adjourn the formal part of this session, and I thank you for your attention and your interest. If you want to come back and join us on some of these other topics, and this last point tonight here, the forum, about that question. Thank you.